Hello, friends. I'm Matt Baum. The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Huge thanks to everyone who helps keep the show going. If you're enjoying it, please head over to patreon.com and search for Sewers of Paris to pledge your support. A quick note, I hope you'll join us for another live video chat this Saturday. It's the 27th at noon Pacific. We'll be talking about musical theater and our favorite performers, and it's going to be a gay old time. There's a link in the show notes, and I'll have all the details at the end of the show. And now, we're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest Bill Fair says...
One day, I opened up the Daily News and King Kong, the Peter Jackson movie, was opening. And for some reason, Judy Garland had something to say about it.
The topic is Judy Garland, Shelley Duvall's Fairy Tale Theater, and The Golden Girls. My guest this week has been putting out a podcast of his own for years, and yet listeners have never heard his voice, or at least not his real voice. They've heard him as Judy Garland, or as Carol Channing, as Bernadette Peters, or as Gollum, but today I'm just talking to Bill, the creator of JudyCast, the entertainment beat with Francis Gumm. Bill has always had a lot to say, but was too shy to say it out loud, so he kept quiet, kept to himself, buried his true self so he wouldn't cause a fuss. Until one day he opened his mouth to speak, and someone else's words came out. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm Matt Baum. I'm joined today by podcaster and creator of JudyCast / Entertainment Beat with Francis Gumm, Bill Fair. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yay. So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
William Powell and Anne Blythe in Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid.
You're not tight.
I told you.
You're plastered.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm not. But I'm going to be, I can promise you that.
Just get that fish out of my tub and get it out at once.
Okay, yeah, tell me about that.
So I used to watch it with my grandmother, one of the late shows, and I don't know why they would play it all the time, but it was good for me because I was able to have repeat exposure before I got the video, you know, a couple of years later. William Powell, just one of my favorite actors, the Thin Man series with Myrna Loy, and then all the way up to How to Marry a Millionaire, Marilyn Monroe, Lauren Bacall, Betty Grable. So William Powell is having a midlife crisis, and of course I was 5 or 6 years old, so I didn't get the whole midlife crisis part of it. And he's on vacation with his wife in the Caribbean. In this crisis, he assumes that he's spotted this beautiful mermaid that's going to take him away from his mundane existence. And the whole film is kind of an investigation of what is truth. You know, is it fiction? And, you know, it's bookended by this visit to a therapist in New York where his wife takes him in. The therapist says at the end of it, you know, the mermaid may have been real because I had visions of an ice skater that floated right through my window when I turned 50 or something. But Anne Blythe played the mermaid in it, and it was just this crazy fantasy, almost screwball kind of comedy. It's really the building blocks of everything for me.
How did this resonate? Because, I mean, like you say, there are a lot of issues here, like midlife crisis and going to see a therapist. That as a 5-year-old, were you like, oh, yeah, I know what that's like?
I just was so drawn to, I don't know, the faux sophistication. All of the double entendres, all of the, I've always loved the sea, I've always loved mermaids. So it was this combination of the two. I knew I was going to live in the city one day, and I assumed it would look like that. I don't know.
Was it like the New York of the 1940s?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think the opening shot out the therapist's window is Rockefeller Center. It's the skating rink in the wintertime.
Oh boy, that must be some therapist.
Well, you know. So yeah, and then of course I got into Woody Allen movies later, so the whole therapist New York thing just never left.
And tell me, like, you were watching this, you said, did you say with your mother?
With my grandmother.
With your grandmother. Okay. And so would you, like, were you over at her house? Did she come over? Were you watching as a family?
We would be visiting her, and I just would stay up late sometimes with her. She had very, very bad arthritis. Sometimes it kept her up at night. And I the youngest of three boys, and by the time that I came around, I was let to do whatever I wanted. And my grandmother sometimes would just watch these movies with me late at night.
And you said it was like a building block for you. So, like, did you seek more stuff like that at the time?
Well, to me, it was the benchmark for a certain kind of entertainment that I would seek out.
So tell me a little about where you're growing up.
So I grew up in Connecticut, out in the country. You know, I never learned to drive. I ended up moving down to New York a year early in high school. I graduated a year early to study music in the city. So since I never learned to drive, I was very dependent on other people driving me around.
That was also my teenage years. I didn't learn to drive until I was just getting out of there. So it was always, and I lived in the middle of Connecticut. And it's tough to not be driving in Connecticut as a teenager because there's so many things that are like tantalizingly close, but there's no chance of getting to them because it's like four or five towns over.
Oh yeah, it's Pilgrim's Progress.
Yes, with shopping malls.
Yes, dependent on the kindness of strangers. Oh, West Farms Mall.
Yes. Oh my God.
I spent so much time in the Disney store when that opened.
Oh my God, yes. My God, we've spent time in the same Disney store.
That's when they had cells, and they had, you know, they had legitimately wonderful things.
So were you said you went to college to study music. Was that something that became an interest for you as you were growing up?
I was always a pianist. I studied piano very, very seriously. I don't know. I knew I wanted to be a writer, but I thought I wanted to be a music writer or a composer, and I just kind of threw myself into that when I turned 14. So in 2 years, I attempted to do what a lot of people end up doing, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 years. It was very accelerated, but I wrote, you know, the spring musical at school. I started studying with teachers in New York.
So had you been exploring musical theater all along? Was that where your focus was?
Yeah, I've always been a fan of musical theater, but I really don't know where the writing came from. Or why it was that I started to explore it. It just was kind of like a bug, and I thought, all right, I need to do this. But I loved film and opera, musical theater.
It was sort of like a mermaid that you just glimpsed.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me a little about, like, you know, from getting from the movie about the mermaid to going away to college to study music. Like, what were the milestones as you were growing up? Like, the things that you kept coming back to?
When I was thinking about influences, I mean, one of the major influences was Shelley Duvall's Fairy Tale Theater.
And yes. So describe what that is, because there's really nothing else like it.
There really isn't. First of all, it's an introduction to the best and the worst of Hollywood. And I mean the best in terms of like legitimate, incredible actors like Jenna Rollins. Yeah, that was my first exposure to her. Vanessa Redgrave. All of these people that Shelley Duvall hired to put on 1-hour adaptations of, you know, famous fairy tales in the early 80s.
Do you know what I'm going to do to you for that?
Oh, what?
I'm going to cut off your fingers, and I'm going to plant them in the ground to take the place of my missing radishes.
Oh, no, please.
Yes.
I did it for my wife.
Good. I'll cut off her fingers, too.
Please have mercy. We're going to have a child.
A child? Did you say you're going to have a child?
And Karen Black. I mean, if Mr. Peabody and the Mermaid was a building block, Karen Black was the cement.
In what way?
Oh, my. Her performance in The Little Mermaid as the sea witch. When this is your exposure to Karen Black as a six-year-old, it's deliciously absurd. And I didn't know the word for it, but I knew that I knew it was something that really spoke to me.
She's got a ton of presence, so I can imagine as Ursula. I mean, was she like chewing the scenery? Like?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me. You don't know me, but
I know you. You're the youngest, aren't you? Opal? Jade? Tourmaline?
Pearl.
Oh, I knew it had to be something in a semi-precious stone. So, I suppose you'd like me to show you something in a nice pair of legs.
Legs? What would I do with legs?
Well, he's never going to fall in love with you if from the waist down you look like the seafood special.
All right, so talk about some of the actors who are in here, because this is, like, when you picture, like, oh, fairy tales for kids, you might be thinking of, like, Little Puppet Theater. But that is not what this was.
No, this was full-out, high-quality, you know, balls-to-the-wall presentations of fairy tales. And one of the exciting things was they would eschew the Disney versions. So sometimes I felt like, you know, I was watching something closer to the truth. The Little Mermaid was dark. it had the original ending. You know, she doesn't get the prince. She doesn't turn into seafoam, which everybody always says. She becomes a spirit of the air, kind of like a guardian of love. But the actors, I mean, in The Little Mermaid, you had Brian Dennehy as the father. Treat Williams, I think I fell in love with the prince at the same time when I was seven. Pam Dauber, so we had Mork and Mindy as The Little Mermaid. Donna McKechnie and Lorraine Newman as her sisters. I mean, then I think of Cinderella with Eve Arden. I mean, that was my introduction to Eve Arden. She played the stepmother. Edie McClurg as a stepsister. All of the Susan Sarandon was in Beauty and the Beast. Ellen Barkin was in, I think, The Princess Who Had Never Laughed. I mean, Bernadette Peters. That's how I came to know Bernadette Peters. She was in Sleeping Beauty.
Yes, madam, I quite agree. I think we have been generous enough.
Oh, not at all. Why, the very thought of this one underfed peasant causes my heart to leap in my bosom. Try this one, it's bigger.
Yeah, it's presented like, these aren't like bright colors and brightly lit and cheerful. It's dark and kind of gritty and realistic.
Oh, yeah. I remember The Boy Who Ran Home to Find Out About the Shivers, and that had Christopher Lee in it. It was frightening.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That really scared me as a kid.
You know, I mean, early Disney was frightening. I think fairy tales were supposed to be, you know, warnings about the world to prepare you. Yeah.
What were you seeing when you looked at this? Like, what was the? I mean, surely it wasn't just like, oh, the as a kid, like, oh, the artistry of the acting and oh, it's so adult. But so, what was the attraction for you?
I keep using the word sophistication. I thought it was so sophisticated. I thought it was elegant.
Did you want to be sophisticated like as a kid?
Well, that was never going to happen. I was completely the opposite, and still am. You know, do I want to exist in a Noel Coward film? Yeah, I do. But that's just my imagination.
Did you try to make your life more like the sophistication that you were seeing on screen?
No. Oh, never, never, never. In fact, when I first started the podcast, I did I think 3 or 4 episodes, and I didn't tell anybody about it.
Well, let's talk about the podcast a bit too, because we haven't described that. What is JudyCast?
Well, I mean, the reason that I kind of wanted to bring up the whole sophistication thing is that when I first played the show for friends or my parents, they really didn't see how it came from me because it was so much of a 180 from who I am or how I present myself. I think I've changed since then, but JudyCast is. It's an excuse for me to embody different characters, to communicate things that I am too shy or too scared to say, I think, as myself.
Who are the characters?
Well, Judy Garland, Carol Channing, Bernadette Peters, Gollum from The Lord of the Rings. Although my Gollum is more of a Martin Gare kind of Gollum. He played Gollum in the film, but he doesn't really know that he is the real Gollum. You know, Katharine Hepburn, Gwen Verdon. Ike Turner was there for a little bit. Madeline Kahn is coming in. Lauren Bacall, Rush Limbaugh, Daniel Radcliffe. It's quite a roster.
You're like Shelley Duvall assembling all these forces of nature.
Yeah, I guess.
So you're just doing, it's like a one-man show, and you're doing all these voices.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I've spent a lot of time.
You're taking a huge risk.
That's not true.
People would rather put Judy in a bag.
She's what?
Sweetheart, look at your audience.
Benatrice.
As you might have heard,
you have to pay our price.
Some people just don't get it. This podcast seems disrespectful.
Donald
is too precious.
Think about it twice.
There's two camps, the talent and the tragedy.
To get a work. I disagree. Why not do both? People love it.
With Over the Rainbow, with a trolley song.
Ah, it isn't easy.
You've got to appeal to the queens.
Even when you're hot.
Why would you want to make a podcast like this anyway?
The fans are not as easy.
I'll take the laptop seriously.
Finance and it is hard.
Why take chances?
This is the vision of Sonya Hare.
Nobody respects your artistic integrity more than I do.
Everyone gets to hear it. It's as good as death.
You have to think about your legacy.
It has to come to life. Bit by bit, putting it together.
Well, I feel like every time that I do the show, I reinvent the wheel, or the wheel, as Judy would say. I mean, the only constant is that I do the show. I mean, what should people expect? We could, the characters might be riffing on a new Broadway show or a new film.
they might be parodying something or having a Dada-esque conversation on art, random songs, doing an entire episode of The Golden Girls. That was risky, but it paid off.
It's an amazing work of art. Describe what that episode is.
So my favorite episode of The Golden Girls is when Jean visits, you know, the lesbian episode. I thought it would be interesting to do the entire show with canned laughter, musical cues, with my cast. And then I found it funny that Judy Garland, the only natural role for her on The Golden Girls is as Jean. She's just not one of, she doesn't fit the main ensemble. I just recreate the whole episode.
Ma, come on, it is not funny.
But how it's not. Jean in love with Little Miss Muffet? Come on!
What's going on in here?
Nothing.
Oh, come on now. I heard you two laughing. What's so funny?
For starters, Jean is a lesbian.
Ma.
What's so funny about that?
You aren't surprised?
Of course not. I mean, I've never known any personally, but isn't Danny Thomas one?
Not Lebanese Blanche. Lesbian.
Lesbian. Lesbian.
Lesbian.
Well. So where did the podcast start? How did you get the idea to do it?
So podcasts were in their infancy. I mean, I think they'd been around maybe for a year because this was in, well, I say a year, and then I read that email's been around since 1940 or something. But it was like publicly around for a year. This was before YouTube. It was before Twitter. Facebook was definitely, I think, still in colleges. And I like this whole idea of anonymously publishing audio content. And there were a couple of podcasts that I listened to.
What did you listen to?
I don't think any of them are around anymore. I listened to one about kind of classic Disney culture. I really, really love Disney history, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And then an opera podcast. I didn't really like the podcasts that I found about, well, I don't know, the gay humor podcasts. For some reason, I was very, very interested in exploring at the time, and I know you're not going to believe this, but I wanted to do a podcast that examined gay icons. Mm. What makes a gay icon a gay icon? From like Maria Callas to Judy Garland to Karen Black. And then I just got scared about doing that or not having the wherewithal to produce something in a timely manner. Don't know where that came from. But one day I opened up the Daily News and King Kong, the Peter Jackson movie, was opening. And for some reason, Judy Garland had something to say about it. I don't know why.
How well did you know Judy at that time?
So after 9/11, I still worked downtown right across the street, and I worked there at the time. I had a pretty rollicking, experience with faith and religion and everything.
In what way?
Well, you know, it affected me deeply to lose people that I knew just to go back to the area after the fact and try to pick up the pieces. And I've never been a deeply religious person, but I definitely have faith, especially through what my mother believed. A little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. And I was just completely lost. So how does this get to Judy? Well, my mother bought me for Christmas the first season of the, well, not the first season, the only season of the Judy Garland show, but it was the first box set. Because she said, you know what, you're going to love this. I mean, just all of the musicians, the guest stars. I hadn't really expressed a very deep interest in Judy. I never was a big Judy Garland fan at that point, but I was captivated by her television show. Just captivated. The clarity, the guest stars, the banter, her ability to just break all of the rules of television of the time in what she would bring up, what she would say, all of her little asides. I found myself wanting to watch just the banter more than the songs. And I found her captivating in a way that I never really found her in clip shows or when people would do Judy Garland, like impersonate her. So I think she was kind of what the Virgin Mary is to the Catholic Church, Judy was to me to get me through 9/11.
Wow. It sounds like she really got you out of a very dark time.
Yeah, she did. And then I started to work backwards through her film career. And the majority of the movies she made are just trite. It's not her fault, but it was a factory. Her performances are masterclasses in musical phrasing. But the films, I've just never been a big fan of the MGM musical. But when I went backwards, once I latched on to who she was, untethered from Hollywood in the 60s, kind of raw, I realized that she actually always was fully formed. She always was Judy. Even in The Wizard of Oz, when she's playing this wide-eyed kid, she has all of these little tics, and I said the word asides, but I really think that that's the glue that makes her so magnetic, because she is of the time, but she's also kind of a time traveler. There's other actors that I think are so fully formed, like Madeline Kahn. You know, you see her in What's Up, Doc, and she's just kind of arrived fully formed. And I think Judy did, too.
This lady claims to be a Eunice Burns.
I am not a Eunice Burns. I am the Eunice Burns.
I don't have a badge for a Eunice Burns.
Of course not. Miss Burns is wearing her badge. She's already gone inside.
That is impossible.
Perhaps you're at the wrong convention.
This is outrageous.
There's this one scene in Meet Me in St. Louis where she's sitting at a dressing table and she says the words, you know, maybe I have too much bloom. And she does it with a wink and a nod. And I don't know, it just separates her from this dream factory, and it makes it all very real.
What was it about that? Like, you know, a lot of people could see a fantastic performance and be like, wow, that was really great. But what was it about seeing an honest performance, seeing her vulnerable, that you needed?
I think for me, I needed connection. People do it sometimes with they'll find an author who speaks to them, and that's their connection. Or I'm a big lover of opera, and a lot of my friends and a lot of people I know will connect with singers or maybe their favorite conductor. And there's a connection. And for me, this comforting thing, you know, was her.
Did you feel very disconnected before you found her?
Well, I mean, I just meant in terms of 9/11, because I felt like I needed to be grounded again. I think also one of the big ironies about Judy is since she is, you know, maybe the gay icon to end all gay icons, I've always felt very detached from the gay community. And, you know, here she is, practically the mascot, and it's not that I felt more connected to the gay community, but I'll say that when I started doing the podcast, I heard from people and I connected with people that I never would have connected with before.
At what point did you come out? Like, were you out as a teenager, or was it after you left and went to New York?
I told close friends in high school. I always wanted to walk into the room and be Bill. I didn't want to walk into the room and be, well, there's the gay guy. And Ellen had just come out. I remember I told my art teacher, who was a lesbian. Ellen came out the night before, and the next day I said, I'm gay. And I would never have done that without Ellen. But I just was shy by nature and wanting to keep a low profile. And I didn't have to, and I didn't go through any of the horror stories that I heard some of the people at my school go through with their families. I remember when I told my mother I was gay when I was 14, and she said, everybody's innocent until proven 21. I said, what do you mean by that? She said, well, you know, don't limit yourself, try it all, and then you can say definitively one way or another.
I can't decide if that's supportive or not.
No, it was. At the time I just couldn't believe it. I thought my mother would be the easiest person to tell. And in hindsight, it seems that really, I think her fears were more that she wanted me to be safe. She didn't want me to be hurt.
Sure. It's what a lot of parents want for their kids.
Hey, look, my mother was a showgirl in Las Vegas.
Was she?
Oh, yeah. She was, she led a very, very colorful life. And I don't think she ever really intended for me to feel badly about it at the time. I just think she didn't want me to get hurt.
But at the time, that probably wasn't what you wanted to hear.
Oh, no. At the time, I wanted to hear, we love you no matter what. And my father was who I thought was going to be more difficult, was very easy about it. He said, okay. He said, you know, if that's what it is, then good. Of course, I told my brothers, and they were like, and this is news?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of gay teenagers in musical theater have that similar response.
I know. I mean, I'm like, Mom, look at what I'm doing, for Christ's sake. What's the
what do you think is going to change?
What the hell is... I've never been a parent, and I'm not a parent yet, so I don't know.
Is that one reason that you wanted to get away from home early, that you graduated high school early? Did you want to strike out on your own and get away from, like, the family and the suburbs?
Oh, no. I wanted to get out of Connecticut, but when I got into the school program... My father just so happened to be changing jobs, so we all moved at the same time. I had a very, very close relationship with my parents. I still do with my father.
Was it difficult to leave?
No, I think it was time. Was it difficult to leave Connecticut? No.
No, I know the answer to that question.
I mean, I was out in the country doing animation. I mean, I thought I wanted to be an animator when I was little. I always had little projects, or I'd be making films. I was always putting something together.
And it sounds like, especially with your mom's background, you have kind of a showmanship or show busyness in the family.
Yeah, I mean, that was the showgirl thing was a temporary detour for her. She originally went out to Nevada to work with the Shoshone tribes on a reservation outside of Las Vegas. And then her first husband left her. She was there with my oldest brother. She had to make a living. One of her friends went on an open call, and my mother accompanied her. And the casting director said, I don't know why you're not trying out for this. So my mother had very long legs. She just had the right proportions. So she did it. And it was good money, and it supported my brother. And this was in the late 60s, early 70s, when Vegas was still wonderful. She said it. She never said yes to a gangster, because then they owned you for life. But you know, never let them open a door for you, because then you'll owe them. But then she went back, and she worked with the Zuni tribes. And she was an engineer / anthropologist / part-time showgirl.
Was she supportive of you getting into the arts and getting into your teens and writing music and putting on shows?
She was my biggest fan.
And you said you got into a school program that brought you to New York. That would have been probably, you said Ellen had just come out, so it would have been around like 98, 99?
Yeah. And what I did is I would come down on the weekends and study independently with two teachers. I was still doing piano. I thought that was going to still be something. And then I studied abroad in Paris for 2 summers. That was great.
I bet. What did you study?
Music composition. I studied with the former protege of Nadia Boulanger, who was one of the pioneers of music education. And then I just stopped writing music in 2003, and I haven't written anything since.
What made you stop?
I don't know. I think a whole combination of things. Boys. 9/11. I don't know.
How out were you? Like, when you went to New York, did you feel like you had a little bit more freedom to explore what gay could be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I felt when I came down to New York that I could be who I wanted to be. And then I'd go back up to Connecticut and I'd be the shrinking violet. Right when I got to New York, I met a boy, and we were together for 3.5 years. My first boyfriend was a 3.5 year thing. And then he went to college. But yeah, no, I just fell in love with the city and the whole life that I could have here.
Well, tell me a little about that life. Like, who was the Bill who stepped off the train in Manhattan versus the Bill who was moping around the house in Connecticut?
Let's see. The Bill who was moping around the house in Connecticut was overweight. and the Bill who stepped off the train in Manhattan in a couple of months was skinny and full of energy and going to dance clubs and standing room for every show on Broadway, standing room at the opera. It was wonderful.
Did you have a feeling of like, who is this person I'm becoming? Or is it more like, I've always known this person and now I'm finally, I can be him?
I've never ever felt like I can be anybody. I enjoyed what was going on. I enjoyed the people that I was with. But I always felt like I've always done that thing where I'm looking to see what somebody else is doing, and am I doing the right thing too? If I'm with a group of people and they want to hang out at a club until 3 and then go to Brooklyn and have a party there, that's what I would do. If I was with, you know, a group that wanted to go to a gala at the Met Museum and check out at 10, then that's what I would do. I just adapted to whoever I was hanging out with.
Sounds like the company of other people was pretty important.
Yes, definitely.
And so you were there in the city studying music, and was it all school at that time?
It was school, and I was already working part-time downtown in the same place that I work now.
Doing what kind of work?
A legal assistant.
So is the music sort of the thing that was more soul-fulfilling?
It was fulfilling at the time, and then there are times when creating anything is the most fulfilling thing for me. But I like to take my time with it, and music wasn't something you could rush. So at that time, yeah, the music was the most fulfilling thing, soulfully.
And then it sounds like, I don't know. I don't know how else to put it. And then 9/11 was just an incredible disruption.
It was. Yeah. I think I should have dealt with it a little bit more concretely at the time, in terms of, you know, my office had counseling that I could have done. And then there were all of these free clinics that opened up downtown if you wanted to talk to somebody. Sometimes it was hard just to even walk to work and deal with the tourists who, even at that time, were treating it like a carnival. And how do you pass that and detach from it? It was hard for me.
Did you just want to avoid having to think about it?
Yeah, I did. I did.
It was Judy that brought you back, I guess.
Yeah. No, she did.
And you said that when you started doing the podcast that you presented to people and they were kind of shocked that this was not the you that they thought they knew.
They weren't kind of shocked. They were incredibly shocked. I remember my boss at work, I played, you know, and I gave him the link, and he came over and he extended his hand and he said, "Hello, I am so-and-so. It's very nice to meet you." Because it just was completely unexpected. And at the time, the only reason that I actually shared the podcast with my family, my friends, was I had done 3 or 4 episodes and I was starting to receive emails from heroes of mine in theater and in film that had found it. And what I really loved about that point in time is this is before YouTube, before you could put up a meme and get it tweeted a billion times. This is when people had to know where to look to find your content. I called it Frances Gum because I wanted people who knew Judy Garland to find it by her real name. I didn't want it just to be a Judy Garland thing, if that makes sense.
Sure, for aficionados.
Yeah, even though it really isn't about Judy, she's just kind of the launching, stepping off point. But, you know, I'm hearing from people, and emails at that time from some of your heroes, I said, well, if they like it, then I'm going to tell my mother to listen to it. And then, of course, you know, one of your guests on your show, Alonzo Duralde, he sent an email directly to Judy about one of the episodes, and that's how I was able to get the word out a bit more about it.
Yeah, how did that work? What, like, he sent an email to Judy commenting on an episode?
Well, yeah, sometimes people would write to me because, well, it was anonymous, so I didn't have my name, so they would write to Judy. And sometimes it was people who would say, "Oh, Judy, I saw you in the London Palladium, and it's so great to hear your voice again." Sometimes it was stuff like that. But in Alonzo's case, I had Judy pick up the 100 must-see gay movies, and she was very deterred that Showgirls was in it, but The Wizard of Oz wasn't. And she said a line like, "I thought that my death inspired Stonehenge," you know. And so he sent an email saying, "Judy, I am so sorry. You know, this was an oversight of mine. And please get in contact with me so that we can make amends." So that's how I was able to get my first interview. It was in The Advocate. And then I always thought this was very strange. The guy who did the interview, Stephen Rebello, he used to write all of these, I mean, he still writes books on Hitchcock and the Art of Disney books he wrote. So I had all of his books on my shelf, and I'm sitting on the phone talking to him for the interview, and I'm in awe of that. And I just thought, you know, it's these little things that you don't even think about that seem to work, you know?
That you're actually connecting with people in this way, ironically, by being someone other than yourself.
Yeah, well, when I tried to take the anonymity away and I put a photo of myself up, there were people saying that I was an old queen that was posting a photo of myself from like 40 years or 30 years ago.
Oh.
And then I was hell-bent on trying to prove to people that I do all the voices, because some people thought that it was a group of people. And that's why it would take so much time in between episodes to produce them.
When you're creating characters or just coming up with who you wanted to have on the show, like how did you pick? Or did it seem like the decision had already been made? Like it was already evident who you should be?
It felt divine. I don't know. It just kind of happened. I really didn't think about it. I mean, Carol Channing happened. Judy was singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And I thought, well, Carol's going to do the descant here. And I just thought, well, that just has to happen. I knew I threw Gollum in because I had gone to see The Lord of the Rings with my best friend. And I mean, I love The Lord of the Rings now, but at the time I was bored out of my mind. And so after the film, I would call and leave voice messages on my friend's phone as Gollum. So I threw him into the podcast because I wanted to make sure the show didn't seem too Hollywood, too old school Hollywood.
Sure, sure. It's not like all ladies of the 1940s and
yes.
A couple from Broadway of the 1980s.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and even Gollum has sort of a touch of elegance about him, that he's Gollum de Smeagol.
Oh, yes. He's from the Boston de Smeagols. Yeah. And he knows everybody. He knows Helen Mirren and the Queen. He met them all at the Lord of the Rings, you know, galas.
What is Pia Zadora doing in there?
Oh my God, I forgot Pia. So Pia Zadora is there because I had a friend at the time who has since passed, and he just assumed that I could add anybody to the show. He said, oh, well, you know, you should add Ella Fitzgerald to the show. I said, oh, okay, who's doing her voice? And, you know, he'd say, oh, you should add Telly Savalas to the show. I can't. So one day he said, Pia Zadora. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I can't do Pia Zadora's voice. So I just decided that every time she tries to speak, she gets interrupted. And so she keeps clearing her throat, and the other characters interrupt her. But they also kind of know what she's implying, so they translate for her, too. And that was just a joke for my friend.
It's one little in-joke. And yet, you know, that's funny because James, my partner, and I have, like, had so many interpretations of that. Like, what is he trying to say that she didn't deserve any of her awards? Or
Butterfly was a scandal. No.
Some kind of comment on Pia?
She has a very multi-tiered fandom. She kind of has those who know her from the B. Arthur jokes, then those who know her from Broadway history, and then Santa versus the Martians, and, you know, her disco pop albums. She's kind of an icon, whether we like it or not. So I don't mind including her, even if only by name.
So these are all, like, really big characters, especially, I mean, the way you perform them, they're very over the top, but they're just also very over the top in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find like that gives you a certain freedom that you just don't permit yourself in any other context?
Yep. Yeah. That's it. That's it, Doctor.
It's sort of, it's the mermaid, the little imaginary thing that maybe these characters exist and maybe they don't, but there's something there. There's something that you need to see or need to hear or need to be saying.
Yeah.
So it's been a while since your last one. Do you have any other outlet where you feel like you can cut loose in the same way that you do on the show?
I have to get back to it. I really do. Because even when I write, I you know, I have so much material that I've written down, and it feels so satisfying to do that. But my mother passed away in March, and she had been sick since October, so very brief amount of time. And she was a very, very huge, huge supporter of mine in general, but also of the podcast. I would share things with her that never were published, or I have so much that I recorded that I haven't put up because I'm rambling here, but I would never allow that on my own show. I cut everything down to nothing, and I just feel like it's hard to do it. It's hard to do it without her around, because I don't know. It just is. Even though she always said when you write, whether it was music or plays, essays, podcasts, she said when you produce, good things happen, and so I just have to produce.
Well, you know, it sounds like the last time that you had to endure something that was very painful, that Judy was sort of the voice that got you connected again.
Mm-hmm.
And not just, you know, connected back to the world, but connected with that part of yourself that where something needed to be said. And so, I know that feeling, that creative impulse of like, when I'm making something, that's when I know who I am.
Yeah. And I think sometimes I can tell when the universe is, I'm really not like a beyonder at all. I'm really not, but I think my mother's passing has made me more aware of what her beliefs were. And so she would say a lot of this stuff to me, and I would say, yeah, okay, whatever. I don't really believe in anything, but you can feel sometimes when something's right and when it isn't.
So what feels right now?
Well, I got engaged in July.
Well, congratulations. That's lovely.
Thank you. Yes, my partner of 3 years now, so that feels right. I'm very lucky. I'm just coming to terms with my mom. That's really all it is.
Hmm. Sounds like she was very much a part of the show.
Yeah, she was. She was. I know that's a blessing, and to a lot of people. I mean, a lot of my friends that just were not close to their mothers, or because of who they were or who they are. I'm very lucky that I had that, you know?
Do you feel like you have, like, in your partner, has he been supportive of the work that you do and has helped you? Has he taken a role in helping you to produce and to make things?
Oh, my goodness. He would do anything to help me produce more. He would hold a proverbial gun in my head. He loves everything. He just says, just publish it. I don't know what you're waiting for. And he's a costume designer, and he can't drag his feet. You know, he has to do his work and have it done. Well, it turns out that the podcast ended up bringing everything out in me that I had only brought out in the podcast. So since then, I think I'm a little bit less inhibited, and it actually helped our relationship. My mom said one funny thing. She said that when I was little and we'd be on long car rides, sometimes I would read to my mom in the front seat. And my favorite author was Roald Dahl, so I'd read his books. And I would improvise and riff on Roald Dahl, thinking that my mother didn't know where he ended and I began. But my mom, you know, she knew when I was writing my own stories. So she said, you know, you were always wanting to do wacky, expressive kind of stuff, but it didn't come out all the time.
Mm. So she could see that in you.
Yeah, yeah.
And is that something your partner, now fiancé, sees in you too?
Oh, I think he just sees I'm crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. It's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, no, he does. But he's incredibly creative.
Well, I wonder if maybe the reason Judy hasn't been calling to you quite as loudly as she once did is that you've got someone in your life there that you can say these things, that you can express these things to directly.
Yeah, I actually had an ex of mine said that he was the one that killed Judy. And that was the reason that I stopped doing the podcast.
Oh, no.
And I said, please, you're not that important. Better. Just kidding. Just kidding. But no, I know. Maybe.
When you got engaged, who proposed to who?
I proposed to him.
How'd you do it?
So, he loves hippos. And Riverside Park has a hippo playground. And we'd never been. I told him about it. We talked about going forever. And so, I employed a mutual friend to help me. She went to the hippo park ahead of us, and she placed a little bag of Levan cookies from that amazing Levan bakery, 72nd Street, behind a tree, and then put a card that I had given her behind this little sculpture. And then she kind of hid out and made sure that nobody took anything. And I told him, oh, let's go up to the hippo park. He's like, okay. So we go there, and I leaned down and said, this sculpture was a sculpture of a frog.
I said, oh God, the frog is telling me something. He's looking around like I have finally cracked, for real. And I said, oh, the frog is saying that there's some Levan cookies behind the tree. And he's rolling his eyes, and he walks over, and then he just comes back with this shock, and I'm on my knee, asking him to marry me. So, and then I told him to look behind the frog, and there was a card. And the thing about about Riverside Park that I found out is, getting back to Judy Garland, she actually filmed a scene from my favorite of her films, which is called The Clock, and it was her only non-musical at MGM. She had filmed scenes in Riverside Park for that movie, and I found the shooting schedule, and it said 71st Street, and that's where the Hippo Park is. So it kind of made sense for both he and I. It wasn't just these fabulous hippo sculptures. It was also, this is where they filmed one of my favorite movies.
Oh, there's a little piece of Judy in your proposal.
There you go.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Bill for joining me. I am always delighted by any excuse to talk about actresses and Broadway and musical theater, and if you feel the same way, you're in luck. We're doing another live video chat this weekend, February 27th, on those topics. It's going to be on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/MattBaum. It's at noon Pacific on the 27th, or you can follow me on Twitter, @MattBaum, for a heads up when we go live. I'll also put a link in the show notes. Speaking of podcast and great lady actresses, for my recommendation this week, I cannot urge you strongly enough to subscribe to the show Lady Watch with Ryan O'Connor and Jason Powell. It's the only podcast dedicated to keeping you updated on over 700 fascinating women in entertainment over the age of Celine Dion, and it is the first thing I listen to every Wednesday. On the most recent episode, Ryan and Jason discussed what the death of Antonin Scalia means for Cicely Tyson types, Roseanne Barr's venture into medical marijuana, and the resurrection of Julia Sugarbaker, plus a very unexpected revelation from Mrs. Brady. Ryan and Jason have a fabulous chemistry and encyclopedic knowledge of entertainment, and every episode is a masterclass in great women of our time. It is also hilarious and strange, as when Ryan received a very important collection of headbands that rendered him nearly too emotional to speak. If you're asking why a show would be dedicated to women in entertainment over the age of Celine Dion, well, then the show might not be for you. But I can't imagine that anyone listening to The Sewers of Paris would ever need to ask such a question. If you have any thoughts on today's show, please get in touch. You can tweet at me, @MattBaum. Check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com, and please keep rating and reviewing the show in the iTunes store. Those reviews make a huge difference. If you're enjoying the show, you can support it with a pledge on Patreon. Either go to sewersofparis.com and click on the Patreon button, or go to patreon.com and search for Sewers of Paris. Huge thanks to all the people who are pledging their support to the show. Check out my book, Defining Marriage, now out in paperback and audiobook. You can find it at definingmarriage.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.